everybody. Ray Lucchese here and
Howard Marks here.
Welcome to the next episode of Graybeards on Storage Monthly Podcast, a show where we get Graybeard storage and system bloggers to talk with storage and system vendors to discuss upcoming products, technologies, and trends affecting the data center today. Welcome to the 25th episode of Graybeards on Storage, which was recorded on October 8th, 2015. We have with us here today Ellen Rubin, CEO and co-founder, and Laz Vecchiarides, CTO and co-founder of ClearSky Data. Why don't one of you tell us a little bit about yourselves and ClearSky Data?
Good morning. How are you doing?
We're good.
And that was pretty good, Ray. I have to say that was pretty close on the last name. You know, it's always a challenge. Thank you for having us join you guys today. So I'll just give a quick overview and then let's just do it, you know, as interactive and questions as you guys want to go to. Laz and I are co-founders and we started the company about 2 years ago. Both of you know, because I think we definitely were hanging out with you at VMworld. We launched the company back at the end of August, and then we're at VMworld exhibiting and speaking, and it's just a very exciting time for the company. So what we have is a global storage network that is a service for enterprises with large amount of primary storage. So traditionally, they would be EMC, NetApp, Dell types of customers. And what we're doing, we believe, is offering kind of a radically different approach to how enterprise storage can be consumed and delivered. So the idea of a global storage network is that we will always be able to deliver the customer storage to them wherever they are and very, very close within a very, very small amount of latency at the edge next to where they're located. And the philosophy that we have is that we really want to deliver the performance and availability and security and latency of a traditional storage array that would be sitting in a customer's data center, but we're doing it as a fully managed service, SLA-based, with the scalability and the economics of the cloud. And I'm sure we'll talk a lot about how we do it, but we think it's kind of a unique and a differentiated approach where essentially the goal is to always be within 2 milliseconds of our customers and to handle the full life cycle of the data from primary to backup to disaster recovery, where we can guarantee 5 nines of availability, hundreds of thousands of IOPS, and very low latency that the customers need so that they could run traditional enterprise workloads or could run workloads in the cloud, whatever they need to do. And we do it at a third the cost of what they would be spending today.
Gosh, it looks like you're trying to take on the whole industry in one shot.
Well, I'll let Laz talk about his background because that's not new for him.
Yeah, I guess.
I had early days at Netezza where we challenged a bunch of incumbents as well. But Laz, you want to chat a little bit about taking on the storage industry?
Well, we're certainly not lacking for ambition, but if you're going to do something, go big, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So you're working under the pinky and the brain theory? You know, what are we going to do tonight? Take over the world?
Perhaps you have to start thinking like a Bond villain.
I have a white cat, in case you were wondering, Howard.
That explains much.
I guess.
No, the fact is that one of the problems that most of the customers that we talk to, especially at the size that we're talking about, that they have, is really the ongoing lifecycle management of all this gear. And if you look at what's new in storage, you really just have more of the same thing. And I keep harping about that in casual conversations. Anyone who will listen to me. People just want to build new boxes that do something slightly incrementally better. So you constantly have that. The real fundamental problem is that your data footprint continues to grow. Storage is it really should be a service if you think about it, because all this gear, it just more or less expires after a couple of years anyway. So you're constantly in this treadmill of replacing it. And so if you think about it that way, the storage industry has not changed ever, really. And a lot of vendors are enjoying basically selling the same thing over and over and over again for the same capacity for, you know, only incremental new benefits to the customer. And I think what we're proposing here is a completely different way to consume storage, basically acknowledging the fact that, you know, you have these life cycle issues with your data. Your data is immortal, your gear is not. And
data is immortal and gear is not. I like that.
I wish it weren't true because you know, the solution to so many data problems is really deciding to throw it away, but it is true.
It's true. If you think about it that way, we offer something that's very, very different from an economic and operational standpoint. So you don't really deal with all this gear. It's all hidden from you. It's inside of our network and it's in the cloud. And after all, you know, the big new innovation of the last 5 years that everyone is excited about, I'm here at Amazon reInvent, and you know, we have 20,000 people almost here. And you never would have guessed that 5 years ago.
$7 billion business for Amazon alone. Jesus, yeah.
That's right. And people want cloud models for IT infrastructure. That is what the main theme of everything that's going on here is. And so this is...
But if that's entirely true, then why do I want storage on premises? You know, I want to just move everything to AWS, don't I?
Not true. You know, so there's this notion of latency that you have to deal with. And as you know, Howard, we've been working very hard at increasing the speed of light to no avail. And
186,000 miles per second. It's not just a good idea. It's the law.
It's exactly. We're going to live with it forever. So.
Right. And so you can, for example, in Boston, where we are, and be able to access remote storage over the internet. It's just not feasible for any type of primary workload where you are expecting 10 millisecond or less in latency, or, you know, if you have a flash array, you want, you know, sub millisecond latencies. You can't do that with remote storage. And what we do here at ClearSky is to apply our networking and caching technologies to make that possible. So you don't have to have storage on premises in order to have high performance workloads running locally. And that's what the global storage network really does.
So Howard, I wanted to comment as well, because I think, you know, especially this week of reInvent, it's a fair thing to ask, you know, well, isn't everything going to the cloud? Isn't everything going to be in the cloud? You know, so who cares anymore about customers having data centers or, you know, connectivity and stuff? And I'm a cloudie from 2008. You know, my last company was totally focused on hybrid cloud and, you know, very much a believer. But I think what's true for the class of customers that we're interested in, that are these, you know, sort of high end of medium up into large enterprise, is they got data centers and they're trying to get out of their data centers and they're trying to embrace cloud. But if you really look at what's going on, a very tiny percentage of what they have has made its way to the cloud. You know, so they've got a little bit of SaaS, they've got, you know, some footprints, you know, some test dev, some stuff that's just getting thrown out there because people decided to do it. But the core IT infrastructure and applications that are running, which could be, you know, hundreds, it could be dozens, really the majority is still some combination of, you know, VMware or, you know, private cloud and traditional models. And what we're really doing is sort of honing in on customers who really are going to live in that type of a world for the foreseeable future and helping them as they more and more put new things into the cloud. That's where we're targeted.
So how does this all work, Laz? I mean, you know, if you're going to have data that's sitting in the cloud and a data center that's sitting at, let's say, Boston, and the cloud is in Virginia, for instance, let's say Amazon, how does all this hang together with sub 2 millisecond response time?
Well, you have to avoid talking to the cloud as much as possible. And if you do talk to the cloud, you have to talk to the cloud over dedicated connectivity that is very low latency. So we do both. We have built a caching network where we have lots of very small footprint points of presence in various metros. And in those points of presence, we keep caching infrastructure. And a relatively small amount of high endurance flash durable storage. So what we've done in our architecture is to minimize the amount of durable storage that we need to keep. Remember, the really vexing thing about primary storage is that you have to keep all that data durable. You can't lose a disk and lose data.
I keep trying to explain that to the VMware guys.
All the VMware guys are here this week, so I can relay that message to them if you want. The big trick that we've applied to bend the economics is that the amount of durable storage in our network is very, very minimal. It's a write-back cache that sits in that point of presence, and it's made of...
A write-back cache, not read. That's interesting.
That's right. The read is sitting in the edge, which is separate from the POP.
When you say edge, you're talking about the data center itself.
Yes, the data center itself. We also do have in that POP a large warm cache, which is it's basically an overflow for the edge, and it's also multi-tenant. So we're trying to bend the economics there as well by not having to provision storage for any one particular customer. And so you have this bucket of cache, and you have this small bit of durable storage, which is the write back. Everything else, all the rest of the data that's sitting in our network is cache data, and it's backed by the cloud. So eventually all your data goes to the cloud. And the cloud, if nothing else, has amazing durability. So 6 or 7 copies, 11 nines of durability, you're not going to get that in a physical array that you have on premise, unless you really want to have six or seven copies or some really elaborate erasure coding that might be able to approximate that for you. So
Laz, you have devices at the edge as well as the POP, and then the storage is backed by the cloud itself. Is that how I understand this?
Yes. And then one last key component of the architecture is the networking. We build and run our own network. It's a private network with private connectivity down to in the east. It's Ashburn, Virginia for Amazon East. And then we're going to have a similar connection arrangement when we open our Las Vegas POP momentarily, I guess, with Amazon West. And so in those cases, you know, you basically can get to Amazon within a couple of milliseconds, 10 milliseconds in Boston. And then from the POP to the edge, this is where the sub-2 millisecond thing comes in. So because we're in metros, we can reach out and touch pretty much any data center with a private line in Boston, in Philadelphia. And we have, certainly in Boston, we're actually in sub-millisecond latencies. And these are all private lines, Metro Ethernet, which is very abundant and surprisingly cheap. And it's all included in the service. So the connectivity is something that we provide for the customers without them really having to manage it. We provision it. We deal with it. We deal with the carriers. We make sure that there's diversity, et cetera, et cetera. That's it. That's the architecture.
So how much cash is at the edge versus the POP? You know, in historical days, there would be some sort of a percentage that would be cash versus back-end storage. Do you have that sort of relationship or ratio in your system?
Yeah, we do, actually. So we have these rules of thumb, but, you know, they're going to evolve over time as we learn more and more about how data behaves over extended periods. So we've been in beta for a while. But we sized everything according to these guidelines. So the edge, we wanted to be roughly 10% of the overall active footprint, so online LUNs that a customer is using. And then the middle tier shouldn't be more than 30% or so. And that is, you know, sort of the sizing guidelines. Now, turns out that we tend to over-provision a little bit just because we can, and it doesn't hurt.
Flash is cheap. Reputation's expensive.
Exactly. And so it's still, you know, when you're looking at our edge devices that we provide our customers, it's 6 to 8 terabytes in general to start. All our beta customers are in that range. And they're doing really, really well with that. So they're getting excellent, very, very close to flash performance.
When you say 6 to 8 terabytes, you're talking DRAM cache or flash?
It's flash.
Flash. And then there's some sort of DRAM cache in there as well, I assume.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so the Edge appliance is actually a very interesting box. It is a 2U. It's a storage array chassis, but it's just a cache. So we don't have to deal with RAID. And because of that, we can optimize for capacity, which is really what you want with a cache. With 24 slots, we have the potential to get pretty large, obviously. You know, we keep all the metadata in RAM, so there's a ton of RAM on that box, and there's a ton of compute. The other thing that we do in order to optimize the network is to compress and deduplicate the data before we send it out to the network. We also encrypt it, of course, obviously, if it's going to go out of premise. Our customers expect, you know, sort of rock solid security and encryption. But that box actually it does all of that and does all the coordination. So it's really a compute heavy workload at the edge.
So when you say encrypt, is it SSL kinds of encryption across the network or data at rest encryption or both? Or
well, you know, so I keep calling it belt and suspenders because it really is both. So we have self encrypting SSDs, first of all, so we encrypt at rest. The minute we ingest a piece of data after we hash it and match it suitably, before it goes out the back into the network, it gets encrypted with AES-256. Using keys that are actually physically present, we actually are using the TPM technology that Intel motherboards have. So we have TPM modules on both ends of this wire, so both entities can identify each other using that technology. And just to be even more paranoid, even though it's a private line, we're using TLS to encrypt the entire communication channel between the edge and the POP. And in fact, even beyond that, the networking itself, once you get into the POP, every customer is isolated. And so there's networking, network level layer 2 isolation as well. So it's a very, very sort of paranoid, isolated, very secure environment where each customer only gets to see very, very specific things and We make sure that there's no crosstalk between customers.
Yeah. I got a couple of questions. So the data is encrypted via AES before you send it to the POP, and I, as the customer, own that key and you don't know it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We don't want to know it.
Yeah, you. I don't want you to, and you don't want to.
That's right.
But that would mean that in the POP device, which is multi-tenant, you can't dedupe across multiple customers because they're encrypted with different keys, right?
That's absolutely correct. And that's always been a stated non-goal for this company. Each company's dedupe domain is their own.
And that's established at the edge then?
Yes.
Yeah.
So okay. can I jump in for 1 second? So, you know, there's such an extensive set of things that enterprise customers need from us as a service provider, you know, taking their data outside the firewall. And a lot of them can be addressed with the key management and encryption that's like, you know, table stakes and critical. And then there's a whole set of things, which I'm sure, you know, we won't have time to get into a lot of detail on, that have to do with just, you know, physical security and operational security and personnel security and all that kind of stuff that.
That's why the guys at the SuperNAP like to show off their assault weapons.
Exactly. There you go. It makes everybody feel safer. That's how I like to describe it.
Oh, God.
Assault weapons don't make me feel safer.
Yeah, this is like our customers are already in beta. They were already compliance and regulatory, you know, sensitive, right? With financial services and, you know, healthcare and, you know, biopharma already, and just a lot of, you know, just that's it. You don't get to work with customers on that type of data till you've proved that you've pretty much gone, you know, through the, you know, the heavy lift and the belt and suspender stuff that Les was talking about. So we just did it straight on from the beginning.
The elephant in the room is the eventual consistency. How's that being dealt with in your system, Les?
So the POP actually does that. What we're doing is, you know, in that write, this is why we have a write-back cache. We accumulate writes, and then we push out a whole bunch of large amounts of data, really, into the cloud at predefined points in time. And we use, there are ways to do this. You can never rewrite an object, and that's how you usually get tripped up with eventual consistency. Instead, we've used other tricks like versioning in order to make that possible. And we've handled the problem, but we're not going to try and do something crazy like being synchronous to the cloud. We're point in time consistent to the cloud, which is one of the things that I've spent, you know, we're here at reInvent. I keep explaining that to customers. You're synchronous to the POP and point in time to the cloud. And that's really how we solve it with our architecture.
So when you blast out this periodic D stage to the cloud, effectively, that's, you're intermingling all the data from that POP, I guess, and from all the edge systems out there. Is that how I read that?
Each customer has his own software workload that does that independently for them. And then we size the infrastructure, including the networking, so that they could all be on at the same time, pushing their images out at exactly the same time. But it's done on a customer by customer basis.
So like a bucket at Amazon would be associated with one customer, effectively.
Yes, exactly. That's the sort of thing. In fact, Amazon doesn't support that many buckets, so we wish there was an architecture like that. But we're the namespace that suitably separates everything, and then we added access controls, just ICE customer stuff.
So is it iSCSI or Fibre Channel at the edge?
Well, today we're in our first release, we're iSCSI, but in the first year, we definitely have plans to extend this to Fibre Channel and NFS, and SMB as well is in there. So we expect this to be a multi-protocol edge. Anything that talks SAN protocols or file protocols will be included inside the box.
Okay, now you got me wanting sync and share from the POP.
Sync and share.
I've gotten to the point where I think of sync and share as a protocol, not an application, but I'm weird, so.
It's a Dropbox infection here or something like
that. If you're going to support SMB at the edge,
yeah,
and so everybody, when they're in the office, can access all those files, then, you know, it's already at the POP.
Yeah. The encryption and all that stuff needs to be carried through the sync and share.
It's non-trivial.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, it's great. Every time I talk to Howard, I get a new requirement.
Yeah, that could be a problem, but...
That's why Ellen doesn't let me talk to Laz more than once a month.
Exactly. You have to talk to me. That way we can, you know, we can talk about all of the cool, you know, use cases that you think we could be tackling. I think the, you know, the real issue, of course, for us as a startup is, you know, we're dealing with large enterprise, like they want fiber channel, right? That's something that's pretty urgent versus maybe when we were starting, we thought, oh, we can hold off on that one, for example, for a little while. We're just, you know, we're just kind of taking it as it comes from the customer input.
Yeah, no, no, I think that's very clear. I think Nimble demonstrated that, you know, very dramatically that, you know, as soon as they introduced Fiber Channel, their large customer sales went up dramatically.
Exactly.
So you mentioned Philly and Boston and Vegas. Are there other POP locations currently available? Or I know you probably have a roadmap.
Yeah, not yet. You know, the launch was for the three initial POPs, but the plan is to be in every major city in the United States. And, you know, the good news for us, of course, is that things tend to cluster, right? You know, there are sort of the obvious places you'd want to be, you know, New York and San Francisco and Seattle and Denver and Texas and a couple of different locations. Like those are all obvious and definitely on plan. But the other thing is, you know, it's a global storage network. So even in 2016, I think we'd like to, you know, sort of be out with at least an initial location in Europe. And, you know, the nature of our customers is that many of them are at least multi-site, if not multinational. And, you know, it just, we need to be where the customers are.
Okay, let's talk for a minute about how the system works multi-site, because it seems relatively clear that, you know, I've got an edge device that I connect my servers to iSCSI and it talks to the POP. What happens when I have, well, what happens when I fill that edge device up? Let's start with the easy one. You know, knowing where Laz came from at Equalogic, I suspect I know the answer to this.
Well, essentially, we started expunging data.
And destaging more, yeah.
Yeah, we basically move all of the, so all of your data, you know, it flows, it's sort of like a spill and fill. It flows out into the POP. And so what ends up happening in the POP is you have an even bigger cache where you can.
I actually meant more, you know, what happens when I need more cache at the edge?
Oh, well, when you need more cache at the edge, we have a couple of different strategies for you. Obviously, we have a lot of extra slots in these boxes if you have only 6 to 8 terabytes. So we can simply just walk up to one of them and put in more devices. Of course, we wanted to be able to scale past that. So we also have scale out at the edge, which means bringing another device and having it sort of transparently cluster with the first device so you can manage them together as a single logical entity. So we have scale out.
And when you say scale out, Laz, you mean the LUNs can actually span
exactly
both edge devices, let's say.
Exactly. So the edge devices, all it does is there's a private network, obviously, that goes to the POP. But you know, on the back end, outside of the SAN network, these devices talk to one another. So effectively, what you're doing is you're creating an even bigger tier of cache on the edge, and the devices talk to each other. So the miss path changes to be more interesting. Whereas, you know, one device, if it is a cache miss, it'll go ask its friend before it goes across the wire.
Right. And then if I have multiple offices in the same metro, I understand it does interesting things.
Yes. It's very easy to exploit the fact that the POP is sort of, you know, as you say, RPO zero. Because there's only one metadata master in a metro area for every LUN, that means that all these caches are effectively synchronously replicated to one another. This means you can do things like, you know, synchronous replication, geo-clustering. You know, even with something like vVols, which is really interesting, effectively we create this logically consolidated metro-wide storage array where vVols can surface in any edge location. So you can basically shut a VM off in one place and bring it up in another place without losing any data.
But in this case, it's going through the POP. So it's the edge to the POP and the POP back to the other edge, I guess.
That's right. That's right. The trick there is that you have all of the metadata coordinated in the POP, and so everyone is seeing the same image of the LUN. So hence, you know, it's all synchronized.
And you mentioned vVols. Do you guys support vVols?
That's right. We do. I like to say that I've managed to implement vVols twice in my career, which is you know, twice as many times as most people. Because
yeah, you'd think.
And then we came here and we did it. And in fact, you know, we're in the process of getting certified right now before we GA. So we're quite proud of the fact that we managed to pull that off. Our team did that once at Equalogic, and we're doing it here again. And in this case, we're doing it in a much more scalable cloud-like fashion, which it really fits the original architecture of vVols.
Oh, good, because the Equalogic implementation is not one of my favorites.
Sorry.
Hey, Howard, you know what I like to say? I like to say that this company is so Laz can fix anything he didn't like about the things that he did at Equalogic.
Last company, yeah.
We always can improve, right? So it's all fun.
So if I have, you know, my development office in Brooklyn where rents are cheap and my main office on Wall Street, then when an application's ready for dev, I can just vMotion it, not even storage vMotion it from one site to another.
That's right. Cool.
All right. So on the request list that you're building, I want a pre-worm function.
Yes. I know.
So do our customers.
I want to say, I'm going to move this on Wednesday and have the system be smart enough to figure that out.
Right. There's some interesting effects of caching, especially in a dedupe cache, that as long as you have active workloads in both locations, it's a large amount of similarity between what's being cached in the two edges, just because there's a similarity in the workloads if everything's a Windows virtual machine or a Linux virtual machine. But yes, you know, pre-warmed caches are certainly on the roadmap. We were thinking about that as another feature that I think would be very, very interesting for customers. If we try to do a cross metro, not just intra metro, but also inter metro, pre-warming is a very, very useful thing to be able to do.
Whoa! All right, so
intra and inter metro, so across metropolitan areas between two, like Philly to Boston, something like that.
It's, you know, remember the origin of all your...
It's all cache, yeah.
It's all cache, and all your canonical copy of your metadata is actually sitting in the cloud with point-in-time consistency. So there are use cases where that's very possible. So you could just move things across the country, you know, from, say, it's not Brooklyn, Howard, because, you know, Brooklyn and Manhattan have the same weather, and the developers might like Miami.
It's almost a disaster recovery service as well, to some extent.
Exactly. So when we think of the life cycle, we're really thinking about not just the life cycle of the equipment, but the life cycle and all the care and feeding of all your data. So disaster recovery is built into this architecture. In fact, that's one of the things you don't have to worry about. You get synchronous replication to our metro pop, and then you get point in time, you know, consistency to the cloud, and so, you know, you have a whole set of a whole set of disaster recovery scenarios that are covered by that.
What's the point in time granularity?
Obviously, in the pop, the point in time granularity is
There is no granularity. That's right. Every transaction.
Yeah, in the cloud, we are. So you set up snapshot policies for your LUNs and VMs and your vballs as you ordinarily would,
right.
And we keep those. The thing that is interesting is that we push all that stuff out every 10 minutes. So you have all of your snapshots up to about 10 minutes ago, or perhaps less, depending on when the last push completed.
Okay, but that would enforce a 30-minute RTO SLA.
Right.
Which for a lot of applications is fine.
That's right.
Yeah, if I can make a quick comment just before you guys move on, which is, you know, I think when we were starting this and we said, okay, well, primary data obviously is hardest thing, has, you know, the most, heavy requirements. But if we don't really tackle some of the additional parts of the life cycle with backup and DR, in a way, we've left the customer still handling infrastructure. And our goal is for them really not to have to handle infrastructure at all. That requires us to really think pretty holistically about this. And, you know, over time, the hope is that these customers will say, yeah, we don't need a separate set of software or gear or whatever it is to do the other pieces of this, because it's just automatically in the service.
And the backup solution is a snapshot versioning kind of thing, or?
Exactly. So we have a VMware vCenter plugin that does, VM consistent snapshots. And we expect to be delving further and further into the application stacks that are living inside those VMs in order to manage their state when that snapshot is taken.
Yeah, once we start talking about backups, there's the state information problem, and then there's the catalog problem.
That's right. And both those things are on the table for ClearSky. We're going to start picking away at that.
The problem from my perspective with backups to the cloud and primary data to the cloud and all this stuff is flowing to the cloud is that it's all in the same medium. If Amazon goes down, like they just did, you know, your data is sort of not there anymore.
Well, so there's more than one way to get to Amazon. And Amazon, one of the things that it does, I think, really well is that it scatters your data across multiple facilities as well. So we certainly have options for customers that want to deal with that that problem with you know, making copies in different regions. So we can actually move copies of your data cross country to Amazon West if that's what you want, and that would usually when I haven't seen an outage where all of Amazon across the entire country goes down. So you have this east west thing, and again, a lot of this can be solved with networking. What we're designing is a system where you know, things like data centers and buildings are also part of the redundancy schemes that we have to think about in order to keep the availability up.
Well, it's certainly simpler than storage networks who would buy any array you wanted and put it in the cloud data center next to yours.
That's right. Actually, that was the cloud in 1999.
So when you say, so your POP devices are obviously high availability, high capacity. You mentioned the edge devices, 6 to 8 terabytes, typical. What's a Boston POP look like device or set of devices look like today?
So in the POP, it's really not a lot of gear. So it's a half rack to start, maybe actually not even a half rack. In fact, I don't think we're still yet at a full rack of gear at the POP, and we have quite a few customers in beta trials right now. And so, you know, it's basically commodity servers, two of them, you know, some, you know, a JBOD, and then, we have the caching infrastructure, which is also, you know, increments of 2U. So you can get quite a bit of cache, that represents a huge amount of data, in that footprint, but it's all commodity stuff and it's also highly available. So, you know, we have two of everything there. You know, we have a shared storage architecture, very similar to what's happening in the edge. It's happening in the POP, except it's denser because, you know, it's multi-tenant and, you know, it's also, we're taking advantage of commodity economics a little bit more there for a number of reasons, operational, most of them. But it's basically what Clear Sky is building is a software company. And if you actually just looked at the rack, you'd say, oh, that's servers and JBODs. Shouldn't be surprising, but, you know, it's all
that's all that storage gear looks alike nowadays.
Yes.
How's it priced? I mean, does the customer have to pay for your service and then Amazon services separately, or is all kind of buried within your bill, I guess?
Yeah, we feel like it's really important that it be one integrated price for the customer and that they never have to be thinking about the pieces and parts that we've put together for this. You know, in the end, we're an SLA to the customer. So, you know, it's capacity based, you know, per gig per month. We have minimum buy-in in terms of, you know, kind of 20 terabytes and, you know, a year commit. But we feel like the customer should just see that as, you know, any piece of, you know, the architecture that's involved in terms of the edge appliance or the networking or the use of POP or cloud or, you know, any of that stuff, that's just all in, as well as the operations and support. You know, a lot of the goal here is the simplification of the model for consumption of storage. So from our perspective, like if we have to, you know, whatever it is, you swap out, you know, drives or, you know, expand or scale or patch or all that stuff, that just automatically happens for the customer versus them ever having to be involved with that.
Interesting. Interesting. So, and behind the, is S3 the, I mean, there seems like Amazon has multiple tiers now of storage capabilities.
Well, right. And so we're using S3. We're using the basic S3 service. You know, we didn't want the reduced durability stuff. Obviously, durability is the reason we use the cloud in the first place. There may be some use cases for some of the newer things. They have this infrequent access form of S3, which may be applicable. But we're still looking at it. You know, all these things, because we're basically for a single price per gig per month. You know, all these things are sort of included in our pricing model. So it's kind of, it's opaque to the customer. But as our costs go down, this is one of the great things about being a service. As our costs go down, the price to the customer just, you know, automatically ratchets down over time anyway. And so
I could see Ellen shudder from here at that thought.
Well, we live in a storage reality, which is that everyone assumes that costs will continue to go down. And we're right in the commodity curve, just like everybody else is. So, you know, that's a given.
You know, that's one of the bad things that that comes along with buying huge amounts of physical storage and putting it in a data center is you're paying today's prices for tomorrow's capacity when you know tomorrow it's going to be cheaper. You just know that because the history is self-evident, right?
That's one of the things that always annoys me when I see somebody say, yeah, we bought that VMAX fully populated so that we don't have to touch it for 3 years.
Exactly. And in 3 years, you basically depreciated a lot more money than you had to in order to accomplish that goal.
Yeah, the sad part is that I've been in cases where at the end of the 3 years, they still hadn't put any data on it.
Wonder about those guys. So you're obviously tied to Amazon pretty tight.
You know, the way we think about the cloud is that just like, you know, Flash and just like Metro Ethernet and just like other things that we're using, it's a component. And, you know, that's something that, you know, Laz has really stressed very highly in terms of the way we've architected stuff. And so, you know, my feeling about this is there are reasons why a different backend cloud will make sense for different, you know, customers, regions, times in the, you know, evolution of the company and stuff like that. And so we never want to be in a situation where we've, you know, sort of tightly bound ourselves to anybody, because I am sure over time we would be using multiple clouds as backend, you know, even just in terms of, hey, there are parts of the country or of the world where the best and closest, public storage cloud may not be Amazon, and we can't worry about that. So,
as a truly paranoid customer, I want my data sent to two clouds.
Well, for sure. Or we've had a couple of retailers tell us that they would not like their data to go to the Amazon cloud because Amazon is a competitor. So how about that?
Well, isn't that what the AES 256 is for?
Among other things.
I actually just have to, you know, make the disclosure that I spent some time up in the Clear Sky offices in July and tested the system in one of its beta states.
And how did that run?
It ran as expected, which, you know, for early beta is always a good sign.
Yeah, I would have to say.
That, you know, read performance felt like an all-flash array because I was hitting the edge cache. And write performance felt like it was arrays doing synchronous replication. So I, you know, had that additional latency, but it was consistent additional latency. You know, I'm not saying anything about this particular performance because it was an early beta version. And as I was walking out the door, Laz gave me 10 minutes on the next beta version that was a lot faster. So it just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, if you think of the system as, you know, a virtual array that synchronously mirrors back to the POP, that's how it behaves. And, you know, I can see a lot of use cases, you know, kind of the whole city of Greenwich and Stamford with all those little hedge funds seems like a great place for this kind of thing.
And Howard, it's time for you to come back and visit us again, because, you know, obviously a lot has evolved since you were here in July. And, you know, we're coming to the end of our beta testing completely and ready to head this thing out the door. So, you know, we look forward to you doing some more, you know, checking in on how performance looks.
You know, a whole bunch of questions I would have in the networking, but I'm not a networking expert, so I'm not even sure I'd understand what your answers are. But it's a private network at the metro level, and then it's also a private network to the cloud?
Right.
Oh, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, so it's AWS Direct Connect from the POP to AWS East. And then it's just amazing how many cities have for metro Ethernet. I mean, when I was ending my consulting career in New York, yeah, you had your choice of Time Warner Telecom and Con Ed Telecom and Verizon and three or four other vendors in a lot of buildings in Midtown and downtown. You know, in the basement, there were multiple sets of fiber you could connect to.
Impressive.
Right, and this is a data center customer where you could have hundreds of carriers, right? You know, we're not doing office buildings. So, you know, it just that's really available to us, and it's a great component.
Yeah. Okay, Howard, any final questions then?
No, I think we got it.
Ellen, last, is there anything you'd like to add to the discussion?
No, I always feel with you guys, we really, get right into the heart of stuff. So I think we're pretty well covered and just really happy that we could spend time today.
And we have to admire how Howard doesn't hold back any.
we know Howard's going to tell it like it is. So that's always good.
Well, I got a reputation to uphold.
Well, this has been great. It has been a pleasure to have Ellen and Laz here with us on our podcast.
Yes, it has.
Next month, we'll talk to another startup storage technology person. Any questions you want us to ask, please let us know. That's it for now. Bye, Howard.
Bye, Ray.
Until next time, again, thanks, Ellen and Laz.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.